We'll be talking this morning about, are there refugees anymore? Discussing the Hong Kong refugee policy. And for your information, to talk about my connectedness with this issue, I'm on the board of directors for Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. And because of that experience, I've just returned I've just returned from Hong Kong in the last month and from the Philippines, where we were very much involved with Hong Kong government and UN officials and UNHCR, United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. And then in Philippines, we had similar kinds of connections. And the reason that we went there was, as an entire board of directors, first in Hong Kong, was to talk about refugee policy and what was going on there related to refugee policy and what the implications are for the policy that is developed in Hong Kong on immigration policy globally. And so we were talking about it the other night in our chalet, and people said, well, I think you should talk about that. I think, you know, people would want to know something about what I learned and experienced and for us to be able to share information. So as we get into that discussion, I'm curious to know whether or not any of you have been involved in congregations where refugee resettlement has been a part of your programming. Okay, have any of you been directly involved in the resettlement of refugee people? What was your experience? Who did you work with and how did you go?
I was involved with Lobok Literacy for about 15 years. And
does everyone know what that is?
It's a particular method of teaching English as a second language and also to teach functional illiterates here in this country too. So it's kind of two different programs, but I was involved with teaching English as a second language using this particular method, which is highly phonetic in a particular way of doing it in. Lobok Literacy has headquarters in Syracuse, New York, and has councils all over the United States. And I was involved in this when we lived in Oregon, and Oregon has a very well-organized literacy program, Oregon Literacy, with councils all over the state of Oregon.
Very good.
I worked with people from different countries, mostly Asians.
The Southeast Asian people?
Yes. And I got the first person that I worked with was a Hispanic woman who was trying to get...
Can you all hear?
Was trying to get her family trying to stop following the crops kind of thing. Yeah, but then when right after the Vietnam War, when we had this terrific influx of Asians, then Oregon Literacy really got busy and trained a lot of tutors to work with Asians, and so now I work with Asians. And my last student was from Laos, and she and I are still good friends.
Great.
We talked on the phone once in a while, and she called me her American mom. So it was a wonderful experience to teach someone a language. She didn't have very much English when I started with her. It was really a wonderful experience.
Thank you, Beth. Anybody else?
I'm at two levels, really. Our church is working with other churches in the Chicago suburban area in resettling individual families and providing support for them in come in. I'm also happen to be on the Board of Education for high school district. And we are very heavily into English as a second language type things, both at student level and at parent level, providing adult education classes for learning English.
Okay.
For working with the high school age students and providing them with proper education with a second language basis so they can learn what they have to learn in high school. Mm-hmm. Right now, this past year, we had in our district, which is a very large one, I was amazed to find out that we are teaching, dealing with 87 different languages and dialects in our high schools. And we have 11,000 kids in high school, so
wow.
We got a big district. But it's amazing to me how many different languages and dialects we have to deal with people nowadays. Now that's not on the refugee side and dealing directly with them, but our philosophy is that we take what we get and we give everybody an equal opportunity on that basis. Well, to do that, we have to provide a lot of special programs for people who are not prepared to, either by language or by prior education, to enter the system.
Mm-hmm.
But our goal is, okay, everybody gets an equal chance here, and we have to find ways to give them that equal chance.
Yeah, that's great.
What district are you in?
211, Palatine and Schaumburg Townships, northwest of Chicago.
I might add too, there that our church, which is St. Matthew in Beaverton, Oregon, directly or indirectly helped about 100 families to get resettled.
Wow.
And I say directly or indirectly, the direct one were the people actually worked with them, helped them find a place to live. Or to get them furniture or whatever. And indirectly would be that either someone in the congregation or the congregation would be a co-sponsor with someone bringing refugees.
To resettle.
Yeah, to resettle. But probably or maybe a family man, another family member coming in with it and that kind of thing, but not as much involvement as with some of them.
One of the primary questions that I was prompted, very realistic in terms of my reality of that visit, to think about was whether or not congregations are as sensitized as they once were, and whether or not there is the same level of commitment on the part of congregations to resettle refugees that there was years ago.
One of the problems that I see along that line is that how do we categorize, or how do we know what we're getting in the way of refugee families and situations? I think there's a great deal of sympathy and empathy to take in refugees who are truly refugees from persecution, that type of thing, and threatened, life-threatening situations. And at least in our area, there's a great deal of difficulty on identifying whether that is actually happening, or are the refugees we are now facing economic refugees. They're not necessarily a life-threatening situations, but they are in lifestyle threatening situations. And that's part of
the
problem.
Well, let me share with you. I mean, that's a perfect lead in to what I want to share with you.
I was hoping it would be.
Yes. when I went to Hong Kong, first of all, there are in the world estimated to be over 12 million refugee people in the country. And in the world, 12 million people in the world. When I went to Hong Kong, we were there to look at the whole issue of first asylum, countries that are countries of first asylum. meaning those countries who, where refugee persons can go right off the bat, as they leave the country that they're fleeing, as the first or the beginning stage in their resettlement effort. So there are countries like Hong Kong, Thailand, the Philippines. I can't think of all of the countries that are first asylum countries, but there are certain countries that are. We are not considered to be a country of first asylum. We are a country of second asylum, you know, a country after, when a refugee comes here, they have been through a process to determine whether, to determine their refugee status. When we were in Hong Kong, in order to get a real sense of this, we were taken by the joint, what's called the Joint Voluntary Agency. In Hong Kong, that agency is staffed by Lutherans, so primarily. We were taken by the Joint Voluntary Agency to see three refugee camps. The first one we all saw together, it was called Whitehead, and that will always live with me. I will never get rid of that vision of that in my head and in my heart. There are 27,000 people living in this camp who are living virtually in a prison. They live in Quonset huts, and there are 3,000 to 4,000 people living in each hut. 3,000 to 4,000 people in a space probably the size of, a little bit larger than one of the lodges. And the way they are housed is on, there are a family of 8 to 12 people living on a space that is 4 feet by 6 feet, a platform. And this platform that's 4 by 6 is stacked 3 high. So in that area, you have 3 families living in a 4-foot-wide space. There are no cooking facilities. There are no bathing facilities. There are none of, there are absolutely no amenities. None. The only privacy that they have, I wish I knew when I was going to do this, I would have brought my pictures. Because it just blew my mind. The only way that a family gets any kind of privacy is to put a piece of fabric over the front of it and somehow try to block out other people, you know. And the way they sleep, there's no kind of padding or anything on this piece of plyboard. And the way they sleep is in rotation. And because there are so many people in this, in such concentrated areas, it's gotten to the point of being fairly dangerous. We were allowed in what are called phases. There are 9 phases in Whitehead. We were allowed in 2 phases and probably 2 of the least dangerous phases. Now, can you imagine you've got thousands of people all grouped in together who are generally peaceful, wonderful people, you know, culturally and temperamentally. There, in this, the first phase we went into, there was no problem. People who had, in terms of our safety, there are 9 of us on the LIRS board, so there's not very many of us, and we went with some staff. We went into the second phase, and that one felt, I was a bit concerned. Because immediately when we walked into this area, and it is a caged area with, you know, fencing all around and barbed wire all around. And imagine, these people are here in this prison. It's a closed camp. They cannot get out. They're in this area just because they're seeking freedom. They haven't committed any crimes. You know, it's amazing. We walked into this area and immediately we were surrounded by about oh, I'd say 75 to 100 people who were just all around us. And immediately, one of the staff people, his name is Wen Wen, who is with us, he's a wonderful man, came in and immediately squatted down, thank God. And he began talking to the people in Vietnamese, because most of the people there are Vietnamese. And he began sharing with them who we were, and that we were there to find out about the policy, and that what we were really interested in was trying to figure out ways to make the situation better for all refugee people. And so we needed information from them. Many of them told us that they had not been interviewed. They'd been there for 2 years and had not been interviewed to determine what their status was, the question you're asking. So, and when they are seeking asylum or seeking refugee status, it is incumbent upon that person to be able, the burden of proof is on that person to prove that they are fleeing persecution. So, but if they never get a chance to talk about it, there's no way for that to be determined. So meanwhile, they lived in this caged environment. In addition to that, they have no opportunity to prove it, and yet part of Hong Kong government policy says that the refugee has to prove their status. And in this camp of 27,000 people, they have the screening process that determines their status. They have only screened in or allowed for 2,000 people out of 27,000. They've only given them the opportunity to seek asylum or seek refugee status. So there are still 25,000 people there living in this space who have no hope. So when we walked into this space, you can imagine then we were real concerned because we were surrounded and there were people there who had glazed over eyes. Some people were obviously mentally ill. Other people were physically ill. They were all anxious. And that smile that you see on many Southeast Asian faces, when, you know, I've worked directly with refugees, and I've heard many Americans say, the smile just doesn't go away, you can't trust them. Well, with the people that I saw, you really got the message that they were living under just incredible circumstances. What Hong Kong government is now trying to institute, and I haven't seen the papers really that talk about this issue now in a couple of weeks, what they're trying to do now is to set up this program of what's called voluntary repatriation to encourage at least Vietnamese refugees, people who are seeking refugee status, to return to Vietnam. And they say that they will protect these people for a period of 2 years. So when we asked, well, what kind of protection mechanism is in place? How many staff people do you have to ensure their safety? 6 people. Well, just out of one camp alone, if half of that 25,000 people went back to Vietnam, can you imagine? Anyway, it just blew my mind. The whole thing is of great concern to me. We saw a couple of other camps that were not closed camps. They were open camps where the parents were able to go out during the day to work. One camp was in an old factory that was in this, it was like a warehouse. But it was like about 4 or 5 stories up. And the children are left there. It's very dark and dank, and there's no air conditioning, and it's hot in Hong Kong, you know, this time of year. And at least their food supply was better than Whitehead. The Whitehead food supply was brought in, you know these big barrels that you see food garbage put in here? Garbology team. Well, that's the way food is brought in to the camp, and it's all moldy and got mildew and stuff in it. And people are expected to eat that stuff. Water is, you know, there are a couple of water fountains around, but I didn't see any running water, and we looked all around. We saw, I'm back at Whitehead again, there was a room for teaching little children, teaching school. There are no trees any place, no plants. The whole thing looks like a desert, a barren isle with nothing there. Am I painting the picture well enough? I mean, you get the message of what I'm talking about. It's horrible. Day in and day out, day in and day out. There was a, what they called a hospital with about three doctors and nurses who were there trying to keep up with everybody, but there's no way. So at any rate, that is just really, it was really discouraging to see that. The open camps are a little bit better in that people are able to get out and go to work. They can go and do something to sustain themselves and save money and, you know, buy things for their family. But they still live on 4x6 platforms also. And they're stacked three high. And these particular camps, this one particular camp that was the factory camp, didn't have as many people in it, but there's still, you're talking about 5,000 or 6,000 people in this factory living there. There was another camp that was the best of all, that was kind of like this, with trees and grass, and they had ingeniously created a library out of an old bus, you know, the two-decker buses. Mm-hmm. And so they had a place for the children to have their books downstairs, and the adults had their books upstairs on the top deck of this bus. And they had a wonderful school for the daycare center for the children, for the toddlers, that is paid for by Save the Children. I saw Save the Children all over, and I thought, this is really good to see, because I've often wondered about, you know, the programs that you see advertised on TV and where you can contribute to the livelihood or the care of another person. And I've wondered whether or not, you know, people actually benefited from those. Well, Save the Children was evident all over in all of the camps.
How do they differentiate who's going where?
First of all, you have to be screened in. That's the first test.
Are the people that were in these other two camps that come out of the first one, out of the way?
They had been able to prove that somehow that they feared persecution. But we had spoken with a person in Whitehead. No, we spoke with a person in one of the camps that was an open camp, who said that he had a father and a mother who were still in Whitehead, who came out the same on the same day, on the same boat, fearing the same persecution, and they were still in Whitehead and were screened out. So when we took that information and we took a letter to Hong Kong officials and said to them, here is a case that we have some concern about, they were not able to give us any rationale of why one had been screened out and one screened in.
Is the problem the overwhelming numbers?
The officials said that the reason they don't want to screen in more people is because they're afraid that it will encourage more people to leave Vietnam. And so they'll have a greater influx of people. They can't even care for those that they've got. And we're saying, why not screen them in and put the onus or the burden of proof or whatever, the burden on the countries who would accept the refugees rather than placing it on Hong Kong government? Why not put the burden of acceptance on the United States and on Canada and on some of the other countries? that are accepting refugee people to accept the people rather than screening them out and sending them back. I mean, these people are saying in the camps very clearly, we will not go back under any circumstances. We would rather die here than to take our chances here and die in the camp than to go back to Vietnam.
But we're not accepting very many Vietnamese right now. We're bringing in more Russians.
I know. Exactly.
You know, that isn't correct, I don't believe.
You don't?
Yeah. Well, it is in Oregon.
Oh, in Oregon?
Oh, in Oregon.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. No, but as a country, we are.
Oh. We are accepting
every year the president recommends a quota of refugees from all parts of the world. And it might say 2,000 from this country and 3,000 from this country and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember, do you recall, I think for this year the quota is around
170,000.
Yeah, around 170,000 that will be accepted in this country this year.
From Vietnam?
As refugee status.
As refugees.
See, refugee status is determined. We go with the definition of a refugee as determined by the United Nations, which has in it this, what Sarah's been talking about, the well-founded fear of persecution if you go back. And if a person can justify that in their processing and their belief, then they are accepted as a refugee for placement someplace in the world. Then countries have their quotas. We have our quota. And we are receiving refugees from Vietnam, but some parts of the country are impacted and some parts will not accept certain refugees. Like California is an impacted state. All refugees coming here wanting to go to California, the land of milk and honey and all of those good things. There are other parts of the country that are impacted and you can't receive. We're receiving a lot of Amerasian teenagers right now. These are the children of American service personnel and Vietnamese women. And so there are Vietnamese coming in, but apparently Oregon is not receiving those. But that's determined. There are state coordinators in every state, and it operates through the State Department of the federal government.
The policy that we have, the church organization, all that, agree with that type of policy?
What do you mean?
Well, in other words, that hey, we'll tell you where you're going to go. You're not going to go to California. You're not going to go to
Oregon. Oh, okay.
You're going to go someplace else.
Yes.
Does the church policy agree with that policy?
Yes, because it's in the best interest of the people. You know, a lot of times there will be family reunifications where a refugee is reunified with their family, and if that family happens to be in California, depending on the circumstances. Yeah.
Well, those
are different.
Happen.
Yeah.
It's what are called free cases or open cases that cannot go into California. If you have a relative there, you can go there. But yeah, it's a matter of areas getting so impacted that it puts a strain on the school systems, on the welfare systems, on the job market, and everything else. Right now, for example, in Washington, D.C., where I direct social services, we will be bringing in this year between 350 and 400 refugees.
But that's another highly impacted area.
Yes, it is, but we can still do that, especially Amerasians. We have a major Amerasian project going there with ourselves, the Catholics, and several other voluntary agencies that do this.
Yeah, because I know in our area, at least from appearances, we're not getting very many.
Where are you from?
In the Chicago area, Northern Illinois area. And I keep wondering, you know, why do they all have to go to California? Why don't they put them up here? It's the climate, the one thing. Well,
see,
I love to live in California.
See, once the refugee comes here, you've got a problem in that they are free to migrate to another state.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
And that's what happens. That's why it hasn't been placements in California as much as the migration of people to California.
I understand that part. Yeah. But if that they come into that, if they come into our area, we're very, I think we're very welcome to, we welcome with open arms and try to assimilate them into the, what they can do there and things like that. Now, I understand that, okay, after you've been here, you can have the same rights as any of the rest of us to go where you want to. And we try to convince you who'd ever want to go to California these days.
One of the things that LIRS does that is that all resettlement and determination of where people will be resettled in this country happens on a very cooperative basis with all of the other what are called VOLAGs or voluntary agencies in the country. And they get together, the people in New York, where most of the headquartered, where the offices are headquartered, they actually physically come together once a week to review the cases and determine who will take what case and where people will be resettled, basically. So it's really interesting the way it happens.
It's almost like the draft, the football draft or something, in the sense that they, you know, who can take these folks? It's trying to move people as quickly as possible. We'll get a call and they'll say, hey, we've got a particular family, can you take them, kind of thing. And our agency will say, yeah. And so they get assigned to us. But it's a big issue, and it's done very cooperatively. There are how many, 9 or 11?
There are about 11 agencies.
Voluntary agencies, like Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, like the United States Catholic Conference, like the
Church
World Service, the Jewish Agency, and a number of others. And we do, about 15% of the volume of refugees coming to this country. Lutherans sponsor in some form.
I wonder what is going to happen in California, where so many of the refugees are going once they are free to make these moves. Because I know how we moved away from Oregon about 6 years ago, but so I haven't been in touch with, you know, what's going on there. But when I was an active tutor there, I'd say 10 years ago. Many of our tutors, we in our viewers and council, we would get together once a month and share stories and whatever we needed to do, and sharing all kinds of things. But some of our tutors come and say, well, gee, my family moved to California, and I need a new student.
Good. A part of the goal.
But it just happens. I mean. And I would suppose that happened with many, many people. And now, in areas like LA, where I think there are big influx, how is it all working out? Do you know anything about that yet?
I went to Los Angeles. What we try to do is to make site visits, so that as board persons, board members, we have a fairly good field. Now, I don't know all the figures, and you know, I'm not a technician, I don't work for LIRS, but I have a fairly good sense of what's going on. And in the Los Angeles area, there are a number of programs that are in place to help with the resettlement effort. And the ongoing issues that refugee families face. But those programs are really taxed. I mean, Lutheran Social Services of Southern California has a staff that is an excellent staff that works to help people be fairly well resettled. But the staff is small compared with the need. I mean, there's just no way of getting around that.
Well, one of the things that has bothered me about that is that certain areas have had their problems multiplied and have had new problems come in that we didn't anticipate, because we didn't anticipate that, oh, everybody's going to go to one place. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
It's very similar to some of the aging problems we have on the old time. Mm-hmm. The people, the population of the country. We have a greater aging problem in California, in Florida, because people, as they've gotten older, have tended to move to Florida.
And that's the thing about resettlement that I think is really important for us to keep in mind, that what we are dealing with is people. And people have their lives, and they have part of resettlement, and part of our ministry is to try to provide opportunities for people to live as freely as possible and as full lives as possible, understanding that we don't control their lives. You know, and yet, obviously, when you're talking about a place that's as highly impacted as Southern California, for instance, you know, there are issues of the systems that need to be in place to be able to just provide for a decent life for everybody. I mean, it's a tough problem.
Don't we also have to educate people like we try to educate ourselves also that, hey, you are going to face problems if you're bringing on yourself by doing certain things. In other words, don't think you're going to the land of milk and honey.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
because
sure.
As you've gone there, the milk and the honey have disappeared.
Right. And I think people who have gone there are well aware. They are confronted daily by the fact that there's not as much milk and honey as they had hoped there would be.
I think they've gone there expecting it, and they've become aware after they've gotten it.
Sure. Well, that's the way it happens with Americans.
I moved to California quite a few years ago and expected a lot of things, and I found out, oops, wait a minute. There are a lot of things here people didn't tell me about.
That's right.
And part of those things helped me make the decision, no, I'm not going to live here anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm moving someplace else. I don't know if the lady who moved from Oregon moved because of some of the things that happened in Oregon.
You moved to Arizona.
You didn't.
I missed the first few minutes, but did you visit other camps besides Hong Kong?
Yes. I went
some
to,
of them are even much worse, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. After Hong Kong, we split up as a board. I was mentioning there are 9 members on the board of directors, and we split the group up. And I was part of the group that went to the Philippines, and another part went to the camps in Thailand. And what I saw in the Philippines primarily was what's called the Refugee Processing Center, or the RPC. And all of the people who were at that particular camp are persons who will be coming to the United States. They are primarily Amerasians. But it has already been determined that they will be resettled here. And they have been screened in, so to speak. So, but the people who went to Thailand saw a much different picture than what I saw. And the camps are much worse. Probably on a par with the camp at Whitehead that I was just talking about. It's not an open camp.
And in that RPC center in the Philippines where some of the problems happen, and that the word in the camp is about go to California. Go there, you don't have to go to work, you can go to school, you can get on welfare, the benefits are large. Everybody tells them the expenses are large too. And so even though the effort is, in terms of the educational process in the Philippines, is to help people understand the reality, the word on the street is go to California. And that has worked against the whole resettlement effort in this country and has put a tremendous drain on the resources of a state like California, especially in the LA and San Francisco area.
Well, those are the things that build up the anti-refugee sentiment.
That's right. Yeah.
Eve?
Yes, I have a different issue. Because I live in Washington State, and there are quite a few refugees that come into the, especially the Tacoma and Seattle area, I found that there's a growing tension between the refugees and the African Americans, because so many of the black people in the area are saying that those people are allowed to come in, in a couple of months, they're driving around in vans and expensive cars, and the feeling is that there's this feeling of racism that plays a part in that the government is allowing these people to come in, get businesses going, get these brand new cars, and you know, blacks have been struggling for years. And so I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I know, that's, I was going to mention the same thing, because I'm from Seattle. And I'm watching this. There's a whole section of Seattle that used to be a rather downtrodden area. And in fact, there's like the corner of Jackson and 23rd, which used to be a place that we sort of drove through quickly because drug dealers hung on the corners. Now it's turned into a Southeast Asian shopping center. All brand new buildings and all new businesses. And I'm also, because I happen to live in a black neighborhood, I'm also very aware, and my parish is also racially mixed, but there is a real strong concern for the fact that these Asian people are coming in, and they're getting all this training, and they're getting all these opportunities in business, mm-hmm. and they're leapfrogging over the top mm-hmm. of the Afro-American population. And so there's a real animosity that's been mm-hmm. real strong animosity.
I'm sorry, but they're being given, I don't exactly know what the amount is, but thousands of dollars to get started.
Well, no. No. Right now, I don't remember exactly what the figure is, but I think it's something like, you can help me, is it $350 per person?
No.
For the agent?
Yeah, every refugee who comes in, we have 100 and either $10 or $20 per person to work with, totally.
Those that want to start businesses?
Oh, no, they don't get any money for that.
At least not from refugee organizations.
Yeah, that's the problem, because there are three state organizations that come in and supplement and do other things and all that.
The people who have been here longer. Is that what you're saying?
Their training programs and things like that.
Well, some of the Asian refugees do have been able to hold on to a few pieces of gold and so on too, haven't they? That, you know, just because they're in a camp doesn't mean that they don't have some valuable something.
No, not all.
Well, but I meant, so some of them are able to hang on to that.
The refugees who came out in the early years in 75, 76, 77 were much more
affluent.
They were much more educated. Ones coming now are not nearly as a general kind of rule.
But the people that they're talking about are probably some of those earlier.
Could be, yeah.
Our experience isn't your experience. My experience with refugees was in Arizona, which is a different situation than what you're talking about. But I worked with Catholic Social Services and with LSS there. And my experience is that what happened is that when people received, well, they liked being resettled by the Lutherans because oftentimes they would receive the money, but Lutherans would basically provide housing and clothing and all of the basic necessities that you needed to be able to get started. And the money that they received was not very much. I mean, if there was like a family of seven or a family of eight at 100 and whatever that is, that's not very much money. But the thing that was interesting to me was watching their resourcefulness mm-hmm. and ability to manage the money. It's not like what I've been used to. Don't say a word. I mean, it is incredible to watch it. And there's also a sense of family and cohesiveness among people that will help another group get started. And we don't understand that basically in this country. I mean, it doesn't work the same way here.
I watched that too in Oregon, because we the very first family that our church sponsored. I think there were at least a dozen people in the family. And they went out, all of the adults went out and got jobs, and some of them didn't pay very well. But they would go out and pick strawberries, they would do anything.
Anything.
And then they brought the money in, the patriarch, the father in the family, was the manager. And they, in a very few years, they saved up enough money to buy a six-bedroom house.
That's
and
right.
They all moved in, and I was in the house, and it was a very nice house.
That happens a lot.
And that's just, you know, over and over. And then they had a cousin who was living in Idaho or something, and they brought them over and kind of helped them a little bit. And then these people rented the house, and then before you knew it, they bought a house. So these are very resourceful people. Very
we could learn.
People.
I mean, instead of the resentments that we have built up, I think that there's a lot of learning that could take place from just watching this. And the thing that I used to always say to the person I was working with was, you know, if I found myself in the same situation, I'm not sure, in fact, I am sure, that I could not survive the same way in their country that they've survived in ours. I mean, there's just no question in my mind but that I would have tremendous difficulty making that adjustment.
The resourcefulness is very good, and there are many things that we can learn, but there are also problems with that, and that is a sense of integration economically. Now, our economic system is based very much on free and open markets, and when you close a segment, that can almost become almost a monopoly or a cartel, kind of control of a particular segment of the economy. Now, that's not necessarily bad if it doesn't get out of hand. You know, I mean, the absolute out of hand would be something like the mafia that would just, you know, take control of some, you know, illegal activity or something. But I think what we have to look for is some kind of sensitivity to try to integrate economics. They need that support to get started, but then you also need to look for ways to tie that community in with the rest of the community without breaking them up, because they need that identity just like any of us need some cultural identity.
One of the examples that we have in our area too is there's been a great deal of difficulty with the newer Korean community coming into an area of Chicago and doing very well commercially in a black community. And they have had a lot of animosity now because it has turned into a closed Korean economy, family economy, serving a black community that doesn't get any benefits out of it.
Yeah.
And they've had a lot of animosity and difficulty down there, boycotts of the businesses, and they're trying to work it out. I think, yeah. But you can see that closed economy that they are used to within their own families, and that effect from the community around them that is used to open marketing. Yeah. Even though it hasn't been a real strong beneficial open market commodity for the people in the area.
So that's one of the dangers of a free market, is it gives you the freedom to close down your
that's
freedoms
right.
and segment yourself in such a way that you control streams of money and take advantage of
the people that's probably one
who aren't part of that.
One of the causes of some of the problems up in Seattle. Same thing that happened up there that happened in Chicago.
There was a segment
on,
I forgot, one of the programs on TV. An Asian, and I forgot that this man came over and worked very hard, and had a couple of jobs, and bought this market in a black neighborhood, and they boycotted.
And they said he wasn't very friendly. You know, he wouldn't look at him, but that's their culture. I mean, they, you know.
Yeah, and whatever, I wasn't quite sure what the real problem was. They mentioned about, that he wasn't very friendly. But the police were there and they showed this whole thing. It was just
incredible.
Did anybody else see that?
In New York?
That's New York City.
It's a Korean home.
Yeah, a Korean home.
Yeah, you saw it in 48 hours, I think.
And finally the Korean gave up. Didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the store was in the African American community and they boycotted it, and Mayor Dinkins tried to do some reconciliation and it didn't work, and the guy's going broke because
if you look back a few years, you see the same thing happened in Miami with the Hispanic group coming in, the Cuban group coming in, and there had been great animosity between blacks and Hispanics down there because of the inequalities that were created.
This is really interesting.
This happen earlier, like in our history too, with the Polish people, the Jewish people?
Every group coming in has the same kind of thing over and over.
The only difference is that the earlier groups were primarily Caucasian groups coming from Europe.
And they weren't visible.
And they came into their own areas, and there were more areas available.
Right.
Well, what's happening probably in areas of Seattle and areas of Los Angeles is that we're having Asian or maybe Korean or maybe Vietnamese regular almost like ghettos.
Urban concentration is what we have today that we didn't have 100 years ago to worry about necessarily. Although there was some of that then too.
Chinatown.
Still rare.
I mean, I think there was, wasn't there?
I mean, you could still walk through.
I mean, you get Polish communities and you get German communities, and it's the same thing.
It's a natural thing to do if you are displaced, to stay with the people that you know. And there's no way that we would ever want to say, no, you can't do that. You know, you must just spread into this new society and expect to survive, you know, without support mechanisms. But there's, you know, that can go good and bad, you know, it mixes, and we just have to take care, I guess, to take a look at that and do the best we can to make sure that people are not taken advantage of and lose their own identity in the place that they've been living.
Don't you think government policy and government rhetoric and so on has had a negative effect on all of us too in the past few years? I mean, the terrible things that have been said about refugees from Central America and the attitude of the State Department toward them.
But they've all been illegal.
It's been devastating on all refugees, it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree. But that's
well, we've got to face the fact that we're not a country of 100 million people anymore. And whether we like it or not, we're getting squeezed in certain areas. And so the culture has changed and the attitudes have changed. When there was plenty of land and plenty of space around cities to grow into, there wasn't nearly as much animosity towards new people coming into our country.
But everybody says we're going to face a great shortage of entry-level workers, and you, all over north end of Seattle, everywhere, help wanted, yes. Help wanted. So, yes. You know,
but
there are.
But nobody wants to do those jobs.
Well, I know, but I think that's why we say that we're justified in squeezing these people out. I don't feel that we are justified.
I think that. Well, one of the things that's interesting to me in that whole regard is the way we set ourselves up. We're accepting around 170,000 refugee people in this country for 1990, I think that's the number. Out of that 170,000, we are only accepting 3,000 African and Haitian people, which says something to me about a policy that tends to be somewhat racist. And also that, and that translates then into a lot of this other stuff that, that you all have been talking about.
The majority of the world's refugee population are not Southeast Asian.
That's right.
Where are the greatest number coming from? Southeast Asia, South America,
Eastern Europe.
Europe?
Eastern Europe right now.
Yeah, I wish we, if we'd known we were going to have brought those figures. The United Nations puts out a book every year that gives a survey of the world refugee and, or homeless population. And I'm drawing on reading that months ago, but I know that the majority are not out of Southeast Asia.
Seems to me, I've read that the majority of the world's refugees are in Africa, and they're refugees within their own country, and they're refugees from one African country to another.
Africa, you get Afghanistan, you get some of the eastern countries. The Southeast Asian population, I think, is less than 300,000 now.
It's interesting to me that a State Department official said to us at a convention last year, a conference last year, that the reason why those numbers were not any higher was because they like living there. They like staying in a place where, you know, they run the risk of being killed. It's just, it was incredible that she could stand up there and say that. But at any rate.
Yeah, you're aware too that there are people who come in who are not refugees, who come in as immigrants. And that's another process. Yeah. And you have to be, it's a much smaller number of people who are allocated to various countries. Problem in Central America, of course, is that as much as many of us who have worked in that area believe that these people are refugees, our government has not allowed that they are refugees. And they're, you know, so they don't qualify to come in this particular way.
Yes.
I wanted to just say a couple of things about the bigger picture, because I think when you focus on the refugee issue, you can't ignore the way that those countries have been treated by Western wealthy nations in terms of holding out their resources. And it doesn't seem to me to be too surprising that the people are going to follow the money. And so, and the thing about California too, it strikes me that the U.S. Markets that image all over the world of what living in the U.S. is like. And when you watch advertising, you can see how much of it is set in California. And you've got, you know, I mean, so we're doing it to ourselves as much as anybody out there is doing it.
I appreciate your comments, because I think that's pretty true.
Well, I wonder how so many of the refugees can afford to go to California. Of course, I know that they're not settling in the higher priced houses, but the rate of inflated market, I mean, houses has gone up incredibly in California compared to other areas. So I would think that even low cost housing would be expensive there in comparison.
And that's what's causing some of the additional problems, is that they are moving to California, and as a result you're having unsuitable living conditions in a great many areas in California. I mean, Los Angeles is not land of milk and honey to live in for 90% of the people who live there. It's very, very poor housing and crowded and unsanitary. And living conditions are not what you would have in some of the worst areas of Minneapolis.
Yeah, exactly. You have to remember where they came from, too. I mean, that experience for me helped me understand how people make the transition. And that the transition is better than where they've been, you know, in the camp where you've got thousands of people, you know, crowded together.
You also have a state environment in which there is a lot more assistance in public housing and assistance with food and shelter and other things like that. It's not well. My impression is that it's a much more liberal setting for those kinds of.
Well,
they
have thousands of people on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
No housing whatsoever.
That's true.
But for probably 6 months out of the year, housing as such, as we see it, is probably not necessary for some of those people. Mm-hmm.
No, we're talking about homeless people.
I'm talking about homeless.
I'm talking about homeless, too. Homeless person in California is in a different situation than a homeless person in Chicago or Minneapolis. For six months of the year.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask one other question. You were talking about the Amerasians many of these are teenagers. The children, are they not at that age?
Mm-hmm. Young adults and teenagers.
Young adults. Are their mothers coming with them?
Yes.
Usually,
the mother comes with them.
See, the Amerasians.
How about other siblings who are not Amerasian? They're coming also.
We're resettling entire families of Amerasian families.
How about if there's a new Vietnamese father? Is he also
coming? He can come also.
Mm-hmm. He can come also. Okay. Just
the Amerasians will phase out in a few years.
Oh, yeah,
because
sure.
We left in 75, and so even if conception took place on the day of departure, by 90, the youngest Amerasians are about 14 or 15, and so a couple more years, and they will be adults, so that part will end.
Well, a lot of the problem there was they were not allowed to. The new Vietnamese government would not allow Amerasians to leave for quite a while.
And there are unique problems with the Amerasian population.
That's for sure.
Because they are neither Vietnamese nor American.
They've been ostracized in their own country.
You know, we sometimes think that we're the only ones that ostracize people.
Yeah.
That seems to be a human trait.
Mm-hmm. They've been ostracized in their own country, but they are not prepared for what they're going to face here, and particularly the black Amerasians. And I saw several of them in the camp.